In the name of God, Creator and Redeemer and Sustainer.
Amen.
How many of us were, shall we say, just plain glad and relieved when the election was over with on Wednesday? A show of hands, please. I thought on that subject we would be unanimous. As Mrs. Slocum used to say in that great sitcom, I am unanimous in this. So we are unanimous in that. I would dearly love to preach about the gospel is fantastic and its pairing with the account of Elijah and the widow. You can see obviously the overtones, and then you have the echoes of the woman at the well from John's gospel. I mean, it's rich, rich with symbolism. But I feel duty bound to talk about the events of this week. Not to put them behind us, because that's not at all the message of this sermon, but to think about it from maybe a Christian theological perspective. So I think that there probably has been nothing recently more exhausting or overblown, or what was supposed to be short but turned out to be almost interminably lengthy, and the way, way, way too much money that was spent in this whole election cycle. I shudder to think what good could be done of all of those millions of dollars. Between that and the campaign flyers that kept coming in, I had to get another recycling bin. All of that paper wasted. And there's some pretty good research that none of that really matters in the end, that voters make up their minds for other kinds of these things. I, for one, am quite relieved not only that it is finished for, well, another 4 years, but that it went as well as it did. This was a safe and non-violent election. I mean, predictions of horrible things did not come to pass. I was impressed with how quickly, at least on the presidential side, the results were tabulated. There were no inordinate, terrible delays, thanks to the thousands and thousands of election workers. It was not contested. The election results were not contested. And I thought Kamala Harris gave a particularly gracious and generous and kind concession speech. Whatever you feel about candidates in general, or perhaps Kamala in particular, I think you have to agree with me, she is a classy lady. She has a lot of class and a lot of graciousness about her. And I think that was on display on Wednesday. Pandemics and elections have one thing in common, and that is they're best understood when they're all over. You don't really know what's going on when you're in the middle of either one. But when it's all over and you have time to analyze results and circumstances and influences, then you learn a lot more than what is leading up to them. I'm sure there will be analysis for years to come about this one. The criticisms of Ms. Harris, nothing more perhaps could be done than she said or did. Discussions about the relationship with the president. She sailed into headwinds, that was sure, but they were blowing in a different direction, not only in the United States, but as you'll hear shortly, in the world. Voters, clearly, at least roughly one out of every two voters, clearly set aside or ignored Mr. Trump's obvious shortcomings. I think out of fear or anxiety or any number of other issues on their minds, but the two that came up the most frequently in polling were concerns and fears about immigration and its seemingly unbridled and unregulated procedures, the number of people entering the country, and of course, the economy. It's always about the economy in some way. Something that presidents take great credit for when it's booming and get all the blame for when it's not, but who really cannot do much about it one way or the other. What I feel strongly after looking at these results and after talking with people, talking with members of this congregation who share the fact that they voted for Mr. Trump, but with whom, fortunately, because we are Christians, we can have conversations not working for everyone. It's not working for everyone. In fact, it's not working for a lot of people, maybe for most people in this country. Wages, income, housing, health care, job security, a long list of real challenges, almost all of which have either been curtailed or diminished, or whose cost has risen exponentially in the last 40 years. A long list of challenges that more and more people, that more and more voters feel that democracy isn't solving or can't solve. That is to say, both political parties have been given ample opportunity to do something about these problems, and yet so far, not much luck. This is not confined to the United States. If you've been keeping track of some worldwide events in other countries, Germany, the Netherlands, France, Brazil, and most recently Argentina, have all faced these kinds of conservative rightward lurching votes, some of which have been upset by further elections, particularly in Poland and other countries. And Britain is its own complicating factor, which just tossed the conservatives out lock, stock, and barrel because they have their problems around Brexit. One theme, frustration and disillusionment, is filling the West, because globalization has not fulfilled the promises that it was cracked up to do. Globalization, which is this idea that we can have democracy throughout the world, hand in hand with capitalism, free markets, open economies, all of that simply is not providing the many, many basic needs and wants of constituents, citizens. Globalization, which began about 40 years ago, is coming up against its limits and is being relitigated by the electorate. For some of the quotes in this sermon, I am grateful to Veith Selk, who is a professor of economics and business at the Vienna University. Nothing like someone outside the US situation to have some perspective. Great writer. This is one quote. "We are in a period of transition in which liberalism's core tenets are losing their credibility. As a result, principles such as freedom of speech, freedom of movement, and free trade are increasingly being rejected or sidelined, even in societies that claim to be liberal. At the same time, the liberal international order, with its key projects of fostering international institutions, spreading liberal norms, and accelerating capitalistic globalization under the hegemony of the United States, all that is quickly eroding." Americans, too, are no longer sure democracy serves them. In a recent poll in October by the Siena College pollsters of likely voters, nearly half said that American democracy does not do a good job of representing the people. And the vote was split about 50-50. To put it simply, why is it that China is the world's second largest economy, whose GDP is nearly $18 trillion a year? And the answer to that is because it is a single-party authoritarian government that controls and regulates a state-managed economy with a system born of capitalist adaptations but central control. That is who we are competing. We have become a global community, interrelated and interdependent like never before. But international cooperation and global cooperation requires agreement and some kind of transnational arbitration systems. They have become elusive, if not impossible. The flow of goods, the flow of intellectual property, technology, and certainly wealth, great wealth, is beyond any one country to control, let alone regulate. When Adam Smith, the Scottish economist and actually philosopher, was talking about free trade between countries, he was conceiving it in the era of sailing ships that had to physically go from place to place. So if you wanted to move money, you bundled it up in a crate and you put it on a ship and you break it up and it's up there. He could not possibly have conceived that trillions of dollars can be transmitted with the push of a button. Globalization and USD industrialization has benefited the American consumer. There's no doubt about that. You can get tons and tons of things for relatively cheap prices. But that same effort abandoned the American worker and turned large parts of the country into economic deserts. And you all know, particularly in the Midwest, the impact of that deindustrialization. It has made fewer people greatly wealthy. And both Republicans and Democrats can take the blame, because neither Republicans nor Democrats have been able to address the problems and its failures. Thus, Mr. Trump, who represents a very different kind of political party, not truly Republican, thus he has been elected, because as many people say, he doesn't talk like a politician, and he says things that many people are thinking but are afraid to ask. And I happen to think that's probably a good assessment of Mr. Trump. Back to Vice. So, the Democratic creed consists of the belief that ordinary citizens can influence political life. It holds that even though the big players call the shots, regular people also have their share of influence, or at least will in the future. The current disenchantment with democracy in many Western countries stems from this one popular belief becoming detached from reality of citizens. Although they adhere to the ideal of democracy, they cannot imagine how the reality of the system they live in could come any closer to it. There are other political reasons, clearly, for the results of Tuesday's election. After all, it was a political contest, so pay attention to the politics. I think that, frankly, the Democratic Party, with which I agree with most of the time, but not all of the time, I can assure you, because that's why I'm a typical Episcopalian, I'm right in the middle of things, but nonetheless, I'm there, you know, most of the time. I believe it is out of touch with many Americans. I think many so-called liberals talk the talk, but don't walk the walk. They say they want certain things, they're for housing, or they're for increased minimum wage, but don't do those things, don't change my backyard, don't change my neighbors, and don't touch my paycheck. I think that identity politics, frankly, does not intersect well with our Christian belief. I mean, I'm a little tired of it, maybe you are as well. I am all for identifying those parts, those people of our society and culture that need upholding, but to create an entire universe about that, I don't think works so well. And also, Paul has reminded us in Galatians, we are neither Jew nor Greek, we are neither slave nor free, we are neither male nor female. You could go on from there with your identities. We are one in Jesus Christ. I believe that our policies should always help all people, even as we care for the least of God's children. Not every conservative idea is a good one, so too not every liberal idea. I still cannot understand that after launching a tremendous cultural shift on smoking and a cessation of smoking and the reduction of smoking, that people seem to embrace the liberalization of marijuana. Now, I'm aware that it has medical benefits, and I'm aware of all the arguments for it, and I don't think it should be a huge offense for the possession of a little bit of it. I can't understand how we rolled the clock back to be putting stuff in your lungs that's not good for you. I mean, it isn't. I mean, it's smoking. Granted, you're smoking weed, but you're still smoking. So when democracy works well through debate and compromise and deliberation, at least when it does, then these ideas get hashed out. And I think better compromises, better results are attained. and we're not having those kinds of reasonable conversations. We had, Tom Williams and I had a contractor in this week to evaluate St. Michael's for solar panels. Very interesting man. And turned to politics and the election, and he said, I don't agree one little bit with Mr. Trump's rhetoric, but I agree with some of the things he wants to do. And he said, you know, I've changed my mind on some things. And he talked a lot about it. He said, a few years ago, I would have never bought an electric car. It was just not something we should be doing, and I didn't feel it was right. And he said, then somebody persuaded me to try one, and now I have a fleet of them for my company. I am all about this, and he is big about solar panels, which he says hasn't taken off in the Midwest, but it's going to. Because think about it, how much more conservative is that endeavor? I've hired hundreds of people. They are trained for this new work. There's a business to be had. It helps conserve the environment. It provides clean energy, just as these cars do. What's not to like about that? Kind of interesting, isn't it? We're not as monolithic in our beliefs sometimes as we think we are. And then you find out from another person that there's common ground. So where do we go from here? Well, we can't go back. That is one thing. We can't go back to some point or period in the past when, through rose-colored glasses, we uncritically believed that things were better, or made more sense, or more perfect. And this is a common reaction to difficult times, and the attraction often of these kinds of leaders is, I will put things back. I will turn the clock back. Cultures can only think about two generations back. So you can see that that's where some people feel we should be. There have been enormous changes in this culture, not only in my lifetime, in the last 20 or 25 years, around gender, gender relations, sexuality, reproductive ethics. Those lead to the top for debate when things are challenged. It does not mean, however, that those are the most important things that we should be talking about. The issues. Again, there are reasons these things happen. The retrograde political program suggests that the solutions to the problems of the present, the real ones, inflation, housing shortages, unemployment, crime, the solutions lie in the past, which must be brought back to life. When a society's outlook is bleak or difficult, formerly dominant political recipes seem exhausted. When the state of things no longer seems just sustainable to voters, politicians who peddle visions of an idealized functional past often gain support but can lose it just as quickly. We've had to listen to each other and cut through all the media garbage. We've had, I think, to understand the challenges that are before us, and our role now is creating solutions to those challenges by knowing how they affect people, our neighbors around us, and we must relinquish our own views and positions that limit progress in solving problems and helping all people. I would not want to be a member of Congress for I would not want to be a member of Congress because a large number of voters, the majority in this case, have basically said, don't just sit there, don't just talk, do something. The question is what? What to do? One of Mr. Trump's admirable characteristics is he has what I call the spaghetti process of decision making, which is to throw cooked noodles on the wall and see what sticks. We all do that sometimes. He's a font of ideas. He's made many promises. He's conjured up all kinds of economic challenges and changes. The question is what to do, how to pay for it, and how can we make any of this beneficial to all the American people? I'm an optimist by nature. And if this election has energized people, gotten people out to vote, if it gets us thinking and talking, if it renews our democratic system, and makes us great again in the best sense of those words, that we have a government by is an opportunity or a crisis not to be missed. Communism was once criticized because it's a good idea, but it doesn't work. Democracy now is being criticized in a similar way. But what if we said about democracy that it's a messy and difficult way to govern, but when it works, when it is of the people, by the people, and for the people, it not only works, but the people will thrive. For us Christians, that, I believe, is what we are called to proclaim. There's nothing wrong behind democracy. It's all through Scripture. And I submit that we as churches have a great role to play in listening, in talking, in caring for our neighbors, and in showing the world what Christian love and charity is about, even as we work with our politicians. Make changes that are so violent.